Arizona desert to house the POWs. One U-boat commander, determined to escape, broke out of the Papago POW compound near Scottsdale, Arizona, only to find himself confronted with desert as far as his eyes could see. He was recaptured after holing up in the dry Arizona buttes for several days. Ironically, the very traits often denounced by the New Dealers, individual effort, self-reliance, and capitalism, were now needed to fight the war. Government-backed science, however, did succeed in delivering what no individual could, the ultimate weapon. Although the atomic bomb remained one of the best-kept secrets of the war until August 1945. The Gadget. Experiments with splitting the atom had taken place in England in 1932, and by the time Hitler invaded Poland, most of the world's scientists understood that a man-made atomic explosion could be accomplished. How long before the actual fabrication of such a device could occur, however, no one knew. Roosevelt had already received a letter from one of the world's leading pacifists, Albert Einstein, urging him to build a uranium bomb before the Nazis did. FDR set up a uranium committee in October 1939, which gained momentum less than a year later when British scientists, fearing their island might fall to the Nazis, arrived in America with a black box containing British atomic secrets. After mid-1941, when it was established, the Office of Scientific Research and Development, OSRD, headed by Vannevar Bush, was investigating the bomb's feasibility. Kept out of the loop by Bush, who feared he was a security risk, Einstein used his influence to nudge FDR toward the bomb project. Recent evidence suggests Einstein's role in bringing the problem to Roosevelt's attention was even greater than previously thought. Ironically, as Einstein's biographer has pointed out, without the genius's support, the bombs would have been built anyway, but not in time for use against Japan. Instead, with civilian and military authorities insufficiently aware of the vast destructiveness of such weapons in real situations, they may well have been used in Korea at a time when the Soviet Union would have had its own bombs for counterattack, thus offering the terrifying possibility of a nuclear conflict over Korea. By wielding his considerable influence in 1939 and 1940, Einstein may have saved innumerable lives beyond those of the Americans and Japanese who would have clashed in Operation Olympic, the invasion of the Japanese home islands. No one knew the status of Hitler's bomb project, only that there was one. As late as 1944, American intelligence was still seeking to assassinate Werner Heisenberg, head of the Nazi bomb project, among others, unaware at the time that the German bomb was all but kaput. In total secrecy, then, the Manhattan Project, placed under the U.S. Army's Corps of Engineers and begun in the borough of Manhattan, was directed by a general, Leslie Groves, a man with an appreciation for the fruits of capitalism. He scarcely blinked at the incredible demands for material, requiring thousands of tons of silver for wiring, only to be told, "In the Treasury Department, we do not speak of tons of silver. Our unit is the troy ounce." Yet Groves got his silver and everything else he required. Roosevelt made sure the Manhattan Project lacked for nothing, although Roosevelt himself died before seeing the terrible fruition of the Manhattan Project's deadly labors. War Strategy, Casablanca. The intense concern both Roosevelt and the British displayed over producing the bomb reflected their deepest fear that Hitler's Germany would soon develop its own weapon of mass destruction. They did not know that Germany would soon begin plans for the A-9, A-10 100-ton intercontinental rocket. In retrospect, if the intercontinental rocket had been mated to atomic warheads, the war might have ended much differently. Allied spies were unaware of other potential threats to the U.S. mainland. Germany flew the four-engine ME-264 America bomber in 1942, which later was converted into a jet bomber capable of 500 miles per hour speeds. The Nazis had already flown a Ju-290 reconnaissance plane to New York and back, taking pictures and proving that a bomber could attack New York. With their fears of known German technology combined with Stalin's pleas for a second front, Churchill and Roosevelt knew that they had to focus on defeating Germany, not Japan, first. On New Year's Day, 1942, the representatives of 26 nations at war with the Axis powers signed a declaration of the United Nations based on the principles of the Atlantic Charter. They promised not to make a separate peace with any of the Axis powers and agreed to defeat Germany first. That decision only formalized what British Prime Minister Winston Churchill and Roosevelt had already concluded in private talks. Churchill, one of the few Western leaders to fully appreciate the barbarity and evil of Soviet communism, repeatedly expressed his concerns to FDR. But the president, based in part on the naive reports of his ambassador, Joseph Davies, trusted Stalin to behave rationally. Thus, Churchill, who desperately needed American war materiel, could do little to talk Roosevelt into a more sober assessment of Russia's overall aims. In January 1943, Churchill, Roosevelt, and the combined chiefs of staff met at Casablanca to discuss war strategy. Stalin did not attend. The meeting produced the Defeat Germany First decision and directed the resources to the European war. It also resulted in a commitment on the part of the Allies to demand unconditional surrender from all Axis parties. Consequently, the Anglo-American leaders agreed that nearly 80% of America's war capacity would go toward the European theater, and especially in the early days, the bombing campaign aimed to soften up Germany for the necessary amphibious invasion. Churchill saw bombing as a way to draw in the United States and use her massive economic output, but at the same time minimize the loss of American lives and avoid early public hostility. Since the prospects for invading the European mainland in 1942 were remote, about all Britain and America could do while building up was launch devastating airstrikes on German manufacturing, especially on those industries related to aircraft production. The goal was to ensure total domination of the skies over whatever landing area the Allies would choose at some future point. Much debate had ensued over the supposed ineffectiveness of the air campaign that dropped between 1.5 and 2.6 million tons of bombs, depending on which aircraft are included in the survey, on Germany and related European targets. Many analysts have labeled strategic bombing a failure. It is true that Germany's production actually increased between 1942 and 1944, and bombing was costly in both lives and money. Several factors must be weighed, however. Nazi production increased because until late in the war, Hitler had ordered his production chief, Albert Speer, to keep German civilian life as normal as possible. This meant that Germany retained excess capacity in her factories until near the end, having never put the nation on a total war footing. Some of the continued buildup during the bombing reflected not a failure of bombing, but of Germany's unwillingness to fully mobilize earlier. Second, in the early stages of the bombing campaign, neither Great Britain nor the United States had fighter planes with enough range to escort the bombers, so raids were conducted over enemy skies amid swarms of Luftwaffe aircraft, resulting in substantial losses. The United States agreed to fly missions during the day based in part on the availability of the superior and secret Norden bombsight, which allowed the Americans to engage in pinpoint bombing as opposed to area or carpet bombing. That meant the loss of American aircraft and life would be higher than that of the British, who bombed at night. B-17 Flying Fortress bombers began regular raids on European targets in August 1942, striking targets in France. Then, in January 1943, the 8th Army Air Force began missions against Germany itself. Even when flying in tight box formations, B-17s suffered tremendous losses, especially when out of escort range. Nevertheless, Germany had to commit increasingly greater resources to countering the bombers, thus diverting crucial resources from anti-tank tactical aircraft for the Eastern Front. Despite the high cost in men and planes, the strategic bombing campaign achieved a decisive victory almost from its inception. Surprisingly, even the U.S. government's own strategic bombing survey after the war tended to obscure the overwhelming success in the skies. In retrospect, the devastation caused by Allied bombing and its key role in the war is clear. First, German aircraft were siphoned away from the Eastern Front, where they could have made the difference against Russian tanks. Second, the bombing hindered the Third Reich's war production, especially of transport and oil, and there is no way of telling how many more aircraft, submarines, or tanks could have been produced without the bombing. Germany tied up nearly 20% of its non-agricultural workforce in air defense activities, and bombing reduced reserves of aviation gas by 90%. This represented millions of combat troops and civilians, not to mention pilots, who were pinned down by part-time defense duty. Existing statistics may even substantially understate the percentage of workers absorbed by the bombing because many were foreign slaves and POWs. Rail transportation, absolutely critical for getting larger Tiger tanks to the Russian front, plummeted by 75% in a 5-month period because of the impact of air power. Third, even before the long-range fighter aircraft appeared on the scene in 1943, the Luftwaffe had lost large numbers of fighter planes in its attempts to defend against bomber attacks. Every time a Messerschmitt went down, however, it took with it a pilot, and although most German pilots bailed out over friendly territory, not all survived. Pilot training took years, placing a huge burden on the Luftwaffe when it had to send up inexperienced youngsters to stop the waves of bombers over German skies. That had a cascading effect. Inexperienced pilots were easier to shoot down. In short, the strategic bombing campaign worked more effectively than anyone had dreamed. By June 6, 1944, in the skies over Normandy on D-Day, the Allies could put 11,000 aircraft over the battlefield. The Germans responded with two, a pair of desperate Messerschmitt pilots who made a single pass over Normandy before fleeing with the satisfaction that the Luftwaffe has had its day. Remember Bataan. But the road to D-Day was long and rugged. Despite the strategic concern with Hitler, most Americans had turned their attention first, in 1942, to events in the Pacific, where Japan continued to crush opposition. Singapore, Britain's powerful naval base in Malaysia, fell in February 1942 when Japanese armies cut off the city's water supplies, having used bicycles to negotiate the dense, impregnable jungle. When they arrived, they were short on food and water, and they took the base largely through bluff and luck. Moreover, the Japanese soldiers only had 100 rounds of ammunition per man left. A vigorous defense of the city would have rendered General Tomoyuki Yamashita's troops virtually unarmed. But the legend of the invincible Japanese soldier already had started to set in, and the British surrendered. By that time, Japan had eliminated virtually all Allied naval forces west of Pearl Harbor. The British battleships Repulse and Prince of Wales had left Singapore, only to be destroyed by airstrikes at sea in December. Australia to the south and Pearl Harbor to the east lay open to Japanese invasion, and Australia found itself hamstrung by its own socialist policies and labor unions, whose stevedores refused to modify their union contracts in order to aid the war effort, including clauses that allowed the laborers to refuse work when it was raining. American forces in the Philippines held out until April 9th, but before the surrender, President Roosevelt ordered the American commander, General Douglas MacArthur, to relocate in Australia, where, as commander-in-chief of Allied forces in the Pacific, he organized a more tenacious defense. Even before the surrender of the American island bastion of Corregidor, some 11,000 Americans on the Bataan Peninsula were marched inland on hot jungle roads with no food or water. This Bataan death march revealed the Japanese to be every bit as vicious as the Nazis. Japanese soldiers bayoneted American soldiers who fell by the wayside or tied them up in barbed wire to be eaten by ants. Remember Bataan and Remember Pearl Harbor would soon become the battle cries of GIs who stormed the beaches of Japanese-held islands. The constant drumbeat of disasters enhanced the image of superhuman Japanese fighting forces. When a Japanese sub surfaced off the coast of Oregon to lob shells harmlessly onto continental U.S. soil, American planners anticipated that it indicated an imminent invasion of San Francisco, San Diego, or the Los Angeles area. Bunkers were thrown up at Santa Barbara. Skyscrapers in Los Angeles sported anti-aircraft guns on their roofs, and lights on all high-rise buildings were extinguished or covered at night to make it more difficult for Imperial bombers to hit their targets. The Lockheed aircraft plant in Burbank was entirely covered with camouflage that made it look like farmland. Local rodeo associations and the Shrine Mounted Patrol conducted routine reconnaissance of mountains, foothills, and deserts, checking for infiltrators. No one could guess that this shocking string of victories actually marked the high tide of Imperial Japanese success, not the beginning. Understanding the psychological impact of the Japanese successes in 1942 is critical to explaining Roosevelt's decision to put Japanese-American citizens of California, Oregon, and Washington State into relocation camps. Some 110,000 Japanese-Americans, most of them citizens, were removed from their homes and moved to inland centers in Idaho, Wyoming, Nevada, California, and Arizona. Opponents of the internment of Japanese-Americans formed an odd political mix. Conservatives included FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, who thought the move unnecessary, and Robert Taft of Ohio, who was the only congressman to vote in opposition to the 1942 bill. Liberal critics included Supreme Court Justices Felix Frankfurter and Hugo Black, and future Chief Justice Earl Warren, California's Republican governor. But even the FBI's own intelligence showed deep concerns about Japanese espionage in America based on intercepts showing spy activities already occurring, as, for example, with the Tachibana spy ring. Liberal historians have ascribed racist motives to the Japanese-American relocation, pointing to the fact that the same thing was not done to German-Americans or Italian-Americans on the East Coast. In fact, both groups already had been under close scrutiny by the FBI and other agencies, a holdover policy from World War I, when German Americans had indeed experienced persecution and been denied fundamental civil liberties. Yet the comparison of the two is otherwise untenable. although Germany had for a short time threatened the eastern U.S. coastline, by 1942 the Germans not only lacked a blue water fleet, but also had not staged a successful amphibious invasion in 2 years. Germany had no aircraft carriers and no troop ships. And Germany had certainly not launched an airstrike 2,000 miles from its home base across an ocean, as had Japan at Pearl Harbor. Today, with the benefit of hindsight, most can agree that the relocation of Japanese Americans during World War II was an unfair and mistaken policy. Although the wartime Supreme Court supported Roosevelt's policy, Executive Order 9066, a subsequent ruling vacated the World War II decision, making the relocation order inoperable, but stopping short of overturning it. Subsequently, Nisei interns were awarded $1.25 billion in reparations during the Reagan administration. Yet, with the benefit of the same hindsight, one must say that the relocation was not, as two historians label it, a policy of hysterical racial repression. Instead, Roosevelt took understandable precautions to protect national security in the face of what most Americans firmly believed was an impending attack. A few contemporary liberal scholars continue to call the Japanese-American internment camps concentration camps. Considering that this same term is also applied to the Nazi and Japanese camps, its usage is loaded indeed. In fact, there existed critical and simple distinctions between the two. Can anyone honestly compare the American camps, where perseverant, brave, and industrious Japanese Americans grew vegetables and flowers, published their own newspapers, established schools, and organized glee clubs and little league baseball teams for their children, to Auschwitz or the Japanese camps in the Philippines where the Death March prisoners languished? Can anyone forget the brave Nisei men who, despite the wrongs they had suffered, left the camps to join and fight bravely in the U.S. Army's European theater? Moreover, had Germany won the war, does anyone actually believe the inmates in the Nazi camps would have been released, let alone paid reparations? The fact that the United States not only addressed the constitutional violations with shame and ultimately attempted to make restitution speaks volumes about the fundamental differences in worldviews between America and the Axis. Yet the constant string of bad news that produced the internment camps and the apparent Japanese invincibility masked a fatal flaw in the Japanese war mentality. Like other non-Western cultures, Japan, despite her rapid modernization in the early 20th century, had not adopted the fundamentals of a free society that produces Westernized soldiers. Bushido, the warrior code, combined with the Shinto religion to saddle Japan with a fatal strategy, employing surprise and quick strikes, all aimed at forcing the United States to exit the war with a treaty. Japan did not understand that it was at war with a westernized democracy with a tradition of civic militarism, an American nation that fought with intense discipline yet incorporated the flexibility of individuality. Whereas Japanese admirals went down with their ships, American admirals transferred to other vessels, realizing that long after their ships were gone, the Navy would still need their talent. Junior officers of all ranks respectfully criticized war plans and offered suggestions, providing a self-evaluation for the armed forces that did not exist in Germany or Japan. Above all, the Western way of war, with its emphasis on the value of the individual and his life, demanded an unrelenting campaign to the finish, a war of annihilation or total surrender without a face-saving honorable exit. American victory, however, seemed in the far distance as Japan conquered Burma, closing the Burma supply road to China, captured Wake Island, and threatened Port Moresby in New Guinea. In its relentless march of conquest, Japan had grabbed more territory and subjugated more people than any other empire in history, and for the most part, had accomplished all of this in a matter of months, all for the net cost of 100 aircraft, a few destroyers, and minor casualties in the army. Threats still remained, however. Destroying the four American aircraft carriers in the Pacific, three of which had escaped the Pearl Harbor massacre, remained a prime strategic objective for the Imperial Fleet, especially after the shocking bombing of Tokyo in April 1942 by Colonel Jimmy Doolittle's force. Doolittle, convinced that the United States needed a victory of some sort to regain its confidence, conceived a mission in which highly modified B-25 bombers, fittingly named the Mitchell Bombers for Colonel Billy Mitchell, would take off from a carrier, bomb Tokyo, then continue on to safe airfields inside China. Even in the planning stages, Doolittle doubted that most of his aircraft would make it to China. Their chances grew slimmer when the Hornets task force was discovered and Doolittle had to launch early. Nevertheless, the strike force attacked Tokyo in broad daylight as flabbergasted Japanese warlords looked on. Described in Ted Lawson's famous book, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. Although some of the crews were killed or captured, three were beheaded after Japanese trials, the raid exceeded American expectations. Not only did Doolittle's brave crews buck up morale, but the attack also so incensed Imperial planners that it goaded them into reckless attacks in the Coral Sea and near Port Moresby. And it convinced Yamamoto that Midway Island was a strategic target. At the Battle of the Coral Sea, American and Japanese fleets engaged in the first naval engagement in history, fought solely by carrier-launched aircraft. Most history books call the battle a draw, with both sides losing a carrier and the American carrier Yorktown suffering what most thought was crippling damage. In fact, however, the loss of the Yorktown, which headed for an expected 2-month repair job at Pearl Harbor, left the Allies with exactly 2 undamaged capital ships, carriers Enterprise and Hornet, in the Eastern Pacific to confront the entire Japanese fleet. Miracle at Midway. What occurred next was nothing short of what historian Gordon Prang termed a miracle at Midway. Determined to force the last two carriers out in the open and destroy them, Yamamoto moved an invasion force toward Midway Island. His real goal, though, was to lure the American carriers into positions for destruction. Midway's airfield had to be eliminated first. Japanese attacks failed to knock out the airfield, requiring second strikes. But where were the carriers? After receiving reports from scout planes he had sent in an arc around Midway, Admiral Chuichi Nagumo ordered a second attack on the island. Only one scout had yet to report when Nagumo rolled the dice and ordered his tactical bombers to rearm for another attack on the island. In the midst of this tedious reloading process, word arrived from the last scout. The American carrier fleet was right below him. At that point, Nagumo countermanded his previous order and then instructed the aircraft to prepare for attacking the carriers, which required a complete change in the types of armaments on the planes. Apparently out of nowhere, several squadrons of American planes from the two U.S. carriers, launched independently and groping blindly for the Japanese fleet, all converged at the same instant. They all were shot down. This, actually, was good news in disguise. In the process of wiping out the attackers, the Japanese Zeros ran out of fuel, and there was another delay as they landed and refueled. Suddenly, another squadron of American dive bombers appeared above the Japanese fleet, which, with no fighter cover and all its planes, bombs, and fuel sitting exposed on its carrier decks, was a giant target in a shooting gallery. Some of the American aircraft, astoundingly enough, had come from the Yorktown. Her 3-month repair job, completed in 48 hours by some 1,200 technicians working nonstop, many transferring to the Yorktown by air to start working on her while she was still at sea. In a matter of minutes, planes from the Yorktown's aircraft joined planes from the Enterprise to cripple and set afire 3 of the carriers, and a follow-up strike by the other U.S. carrier's reserves the following day destroyed the 4th. All had to be scuttled when their tow ships could not get them back to Japan. Yorktown herself was again badly damaged and was sunk by a Japanese sub on her way back to Pearl. But the United States had pulled off its miracle. Not only did Japan lose 4 modern carriers, plus the Soho, which had been lost at Coral Sea, leaving them with barely half of their entire force, but Japan also lost nearly 100 trained pilots. Japan never recovered, and in the blink of an eye, the Empire's hopes for victory had vanished. The Japanese never won another substantial victory, and even though bloody fighting continued on many islands, Japan, for all intents and purposes, lost the war in June 1942. The end of the Thousand-Year Reich. Germany's invasion of Russia in June 1941 led to a string of victories as sweeping and unrelenting as Japan's early conquest of Asia, putting Nazi forces just 10 miles outside Moscow. In retrospect, the German assault on Russia was a huge blunder, pitting Nazi armies against the bottomless pit of Soviet manpower and the vastness of Russian geography. At the time, even many Wehrmacht officers knew they lacked the resources to pull off such a military operation. Germany's supply lines were widely overextended, and Hitler's generals, who had warned him they needed far more trucks and tanks, displayed astonishment at the incredible size of Russia, which seemed to swallow up their army. Nevertheless, Nazi successes led Stalin's diplomats to press the British and Americans for immediate relief through an invasion of Europe. As of 1942, neither the United States nor Britain, nor certainly the limited Free French or Polish forces that had retreated to England, had nearly enough men or materiel in place to achieve a successful invasion of France from the English Channel. In August 1942, the British tried a mini-invasion called a reconnaissance in force at Dieppe, which proved a disaster. The debacle did, however, alert Eisenhower to the difficulties of breaching Hitler's defenses, called the Atlantic Wall, which was a gigantic series of concrete barriers, pillboxes, barbed wire, minefields, and tank traps built by tens of thousands of slave laborers and prisoners of war. Between January 1942 and July 1943, the war continued on another hidden but absolutely vital front. Germany's U-boats had conducted a devastating undersea war against shipping from America to Britain and the Soviet Union. Whatever industrial might the United States had was meaningless if it was unable to get war materials and food to England and Russia. In January 1942, a German submarine force of only 6 vessels unleashed a ferocious series of attacks on ships leaving U.S. ports. Many were sunk within sight of the coast, their silhouettes having marked them as easy targets against the lights of the cities. During a 6-month period, a handful of U-boats sank 568 Allied ships. Carefully moving his forces around, German Admiral Karl Dönitz kept the Allies off balance, returning to the North Atlantic in November 1942, when many escorts had been diverted to support the landings in Africa. That month, Dönitz's U-boats sank 117 ships. This rate of sinking exceeded even Henry Kaiser's incredible capacity to build Liberty ships. Finally, under the direction of Admiral Ernest King, a combination of air cover, added escorts, including small carrier escorts that could launch anti-submarine aircraft quickly, and the convoy system, the United States slowly turned the U-boat war around. New location devices, sonar and radar, aided in the search for subs, as did the application of information gained from the Ultra code-breaking team. By May 1943, when 30 U-boats were sunk, the Allies had made the sea lanes relatively safe. Again, however, only a narrow margin separated victory from defeat. A handful of subs had come close to winning the war in the Atlantic. Had Hitler shifted even a minimal amount of resources to building additional subs in 1941-42, there could have been disastrous consequences for the Allies. In the meantime, Germany's success in Africa under General Erwin Rommel, the Desert Fox, had convinced General Dwight D. Ike Eisenhower, commander of the Allied forces in Northwest Africa, that the British plan for retaking North Africa was both necessary and feasible. Ike commanded a multinational force, with the November 1942 landings in Casablanca, French Morocco, Algiers, and Oran now opening a true second front in North Africa. Americans under Eisenhower now closed in on Rommel from the west, while British General Bernard Montgomery's Desert Rats of the Eighth Army pushed into Tunisia from Libya in the east. Cornered there, the Germans' final hope of pushing eastward to link up with the Japanese vanished. Allied control of the air and sea space in the Mediterranean left the Axis forces completely isolated. In May 1943, more than 250,000 German and Italian soldiers surrendered, dealing Hitler his first serious defeat and securing the Mediterranean for Allied navies once and for all. But Allied forces failed to bag the Desert Fox, who escaped to supervise construction of the Atlantic Wall that the Allies would have to breach in June 1944. Axis power in the Mediterranean was also fatally damaged by the inability of the combined German-Italian forces to bomb or starve Little Malta into submission. Some 3,000 bombing missions were ordered against the island, which at times was defended by only a half dozen biplanes, that resulted in sinking 31 resupply ships. At one point, the Germans turned back almost all of the vessels in a critical convoy until the fate of Malta rested on the world's fastest freighter, the SS Ohio. Through the efforts of two Americans, Fred Larson and Francis Dale, the Ohio limped into Malta to deliver tons of precious oil that kept the aircraft, generators, and anti-air operations alive. Upon such slender threads is history often woven. Germany's defeat in North Africa technically opened for Stalin his much-desired Second Front, but to little avail. Hitler had dedicated no more than a small portion of Germany's resources to Africa. However, Sicily and later mainland Italy now lay open for invasion. In July 1943, after deceiving the Germans with an elaborate hoax involving a corpse that washed ashore in Spain with information that the invasion would occur in Greece, Patton and Montgomery invaded Sicily at different spots on the island. The ruse worked. Hitler had reinforced Greece, and advancing American troops encountered enthusiastic Italian citizens who greeted the liberators with cries of "Down with Mussolini" and "Long live America!" Italian soldiers surrendered by the thousands, and townspeople threw flowers at GIs and gave them wine and bread. If the Italian army no longer posed a threat to the invaders, the German troops that remained proved far more determined and skillful, mining roads, blowing up bridges, and otherwise successfully delaying the Allied advances long enough to escape back to the Italian mainland. The defeat on Sicily coincided with increased Italian dissatisfaction with Mussolini and his unpopular war, and it occurred at a pivotal moment during the struggle in the East. Hitler, weighing whether to continue the offensive at Kursk with reinforcements or to divert them to Italy, chose the latter. His concerns about Italian allegiance were well-founded. While the forces were en route, Allied aircraft dropped propaganda leaflets urging the Italian people to abandon the regime. And on July 24, 1943, even the fascist ministers in the Grand Council agreed to hand control of the Italian army back to the king, Victor Emmanuel III, who accepted Mussolini's resignation. Marshal Pietro Badoglio, Il Duce's successor, signed an unconditional surrender in September 1943. Germany reacted before the Allies could actually occupy the mainland of Italy or before Mussolini himself could be captured. But from that point forward, the Eastern Front's reserves went into permanent decline as Hitler was forced to throw increasingly large numbers of troops against the British and Americans. The Nazis' 13 divisions, more than 100,000 men, arrived, seized Rome and other major cities, and freed Mussolini from his house arrest, reinstalling him as a puppet dictator. That meant, of course, that Hitler was then calling the shots for all of Italy. German General Albert Kesselring, who directed the German defense, instructed his troops to dig in across the rocky northern part of the country and fortify every pass. Patton's open-field tank tactics would have been useless even if he had remained in command, but an incident in which he slapped a soldier for cowardice on two separate occasions prompted Eisenhower to discipline him. Patton's temper tantrum, which his biographer suggests may have been caused by the general's own battle fatigue, was a blessing in disguise because it saved him from a slow and bloody slog up the Italian coast. Murderous fire and dogged resistance by the Germans delayed the American conquest of Italy, which had other unintended effects. A rapid Italian campaign would have enabled the Anglo-American forces to invade the Balkans, preventing Eastern Europe from falling into the grasp of the Red Army. Instead, Naples fell on September 30, 1943, after which Allied troops plodded inch by inch up the coast, covering less than 100 miles by June 1944, when Rome was liberated. Only 2 days before the D-Day invasion. The Longest Day. Thanks to growing air superiority and the late-adopted convoy system, by 1943, the United States had turned a trickle of supplies maintained by a tenuous lifeline through the submarine packs into a flood that poured through open ocean pipelines. On any given day, more than 30 convoys were at sea with more than 650 merchant ships and 140 escorts. After mid-year, virtually none of the troop ships were lost to torpedoes. This stream of materials and men had made possible the invasion of Sicily and Italy, and now it opened the door for the invasion of France. All along, Roosevelt and Churchill, despite their hopes for a quick surge up the coast of Italy, knew that talk of the soft underbelly of Europe was just that, and an invasion of France by sea was necessary. Planners had concluded that an invasion could only occur during summer months, given the tides along the beaches at Normandy, where the Allies wanted to land, and the weather that would permit air cover. In December 1943, Roosevelt and Churchill appointed General Eisenhower commander of the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force, SHAFE, headquartered in London. As a masterful diversion, Patton, who had been languishing in Eisenhower's doghouse because of his Sicilian slaps, was ordered to set up a vast and completely phony army poised to attack the Pas-de-Calais, exactly where Hitler had determined the Allies would strike. But Ike had other ideas. The real invasion was to occur 200 miles away on the beaches of Normandy, where there was more room and fewer German ports or defenses. Operation Overlord involved more than 1.6 million American soldiers, as well as British, Canadians, Poles, and Free French. In retrospect, the invasion seemed destined for success from the outset. The Allies owned the air and sea lanes, they vastly outnumbered the defenders, some of whom were the unlikeliest of conscripts, including a handful of Korean POWs, and they had the French and Belgian resistance movements to assist behind the lines. At the time, however, the invasion presented countless dangers and could have collapsed at any of a number of points. Lingering in the minds of Allied planners was the Canadian disaster at Dieppe and the ill-fated landing at Anzio. Churchill worried about another potential catastrophe, perhaps a new Dunkirk, and Ike's own advisors estimated the odds of success at no better than even. Nevertheless, the Allies possessed overwhelming air and sea superiority, large numbers of fresh troops, and the element of surprise. They read the German secret Enigma codes, which provided crucial, often pinpoint intelligence. The bombing campaign had already severely winnowed not only the Luftwaffe, but the regular army and defensive positions. Both the American and British forces had good field commanders like Patton, who did not participate in the invasion itself and remained in England as a decoy, and General Omar Bradley, and of course could rely on the steady, if unspectacular, British Field Marshal Montgomery, who was badly hobbled by losses suffered before the Americans entered the war. Facing them, the German commander was no less than the famed Desert Fox, Rommel himself, who had organized a thorough network of coastal defenses, including mines, barbed wire, tank traps, bunkers, and pillboxes, all topped off with a series of trenches running along the high ground above the beaches. Rommel had strenuously argued for concentrating his forces, including the reserves of panzers, close to the beaches and fighting at the water's edge. His superior, Field Marshal Gerd von Rundstedt, favored allowing the enemy to land, then striking before they could consolidate. As a result, the Germans had infantry at the beaches, tanks in the rear, and little coordination between them. Rommel appreciated the difficulty of the situation and prophesied that there would only be one chance to defeat the invasion and perhaps decide the entire war. "The war will be won or lost on the beaches. We'll have only one chance to stop the enemy, and that's while he's in the water." It would be, he observed, the longest day of the war. Eisenhower had to consider another enemy, the weather, which could do as much damage to the invasion fleet as the Germans. On June 4th, when he had originally planned to launch Overlord, strong winds, rain, and waves scuttled the landings. Weather forecasts suggested that they had a 36-hour window to invade or risk delaying another month. And that, in turn, could hang up Allied troops on the Siegfried Line in winter. More than 2,700 ships headed across the channel, and on the night of June 5th, thousands of airborne and glider troops of the 101st Airborne and 82nd Airborne dropped in behind the beaches to disrupt communications and transportation and to hold key bridges. Although some units were blown as far as 35 miles off course by high winds, most of them secured the important causeways and bridges, aided by thousands of human-looking, one-third scale dummy paratroopers that fell from the sky along with the real soldiers. The dummies contributed to the confusion and chaos of German forces holding key towns. Next, at dawn on D-Day, June 6, 1944, came more than 11,000 aircraft, pounding targets and raining bombs onto the German positions. Unfortunately, clouds and smoke obscured the targets, and the air cover contributed little to relieving the hell on the beaches when the first units went ashore. Fighting on parts of Omaha Beach proved particularly gruesome. Hundreds of men drowned in the choppy channel water. German gunners peppered the ramps of the landing boats with machine gun and sniper fire even before they dropped, pinning the helpless men behind the dead and wounded in front of them. And a murderous crossfire slaughtered 197 out of 205 men in a single rifle company. Even if the men leaped over the side of the Higgins boats, the rain of fire from the bluffs raked the water mercilessly, if the weight of their own packs and equipment did not drown them first. All the troops could do was frantically run or crawl to the sand dunes at the base of the Atlantic Wall, where they were temporarily immune from fire, but where they also remained helpless to strike back. One heroic tank group, whose Higgins boat was unable to get any closer than 3 miles from shore, insisted on plunging into the water. All the tankers drowned trying to reach land. Meanwhile, those trapped ashore had to attack or die. Rising as if one, thousands of Americans on the beaches rose at the urging of brave captains, lieutenants, and sergeants and assaulted the defenses. One colonel urged his men on, screaming, "There are only two kinds of people on this beach, those who are dead and those who will be. Move in!" Slowly, the enemy positions collapsed, and as each fell, the overlapping fields of fire vanished, allowing still more GIs to pour ashore. By the end of the day, Allied beachheads penetrated as far inland as 7 miles. What Rommel had predicted would be the longest day of the war was over, and the Allies held the field. But more than 10,000 Allied soldiers were dead or wounded. Despite the carnage on Omaha, however, the inability of the Atlantic Wall to contain the invaders had to be considered one of the greatest military failures of the war. Churchill hailed the invasion. "What a plan!" he said to Parliament, and even Stalin called the invasion unprecedented in history, with its vast conception and its orderly execution. All along, though, Ike had known that the Normandy invasion contained enormous risks for potential disaster. He had, therefore, drafted a statement in the afternoon of June 5th, hours before the first airborne troops would touch European soil. "Our landings have failed, and I have withdrawn the troops. Any blame is mine alone." In failure, Eisenhower was willing to shoulder all the blame, yet in victory, he gladly shared credit with his commanders and his troops. "It just shows what free men will do rather than be slaves," he told reporter Walter Cronkite in 1964. Within 2 months, the Allies held a tactical beachhead and had brought in enough supplies that at the end of July, they could attempt a breakout. Using a devastating air bombardment, this time extremely effective, Bradley's troops punched out at Saint-Lô. With the Americans coming down from the northeast behind the enemy and the British and Americans from the west, the German 7th Army was nearly encircled. Hitler ordered a counterattack to drive between the armies, but once again, ULTRA, the code-breaking operation, allowed the Allies to place anti-tank guns in defensive positions to slaughter the advancing panzers. Hitler finally ordered a retreat. German forces now rushed to escape complete encirclement. Thanks to a rearguard defense at the Falaise Gap, Montgomery allowed almost one-third of the German forces to escape the pincer, but overall the disaster was the worst German defeat since Stalingrad, and it ensured the liberation of France. Moreover, Patton, reassigned to command of the U.S. Third Army, was now in his element, in the open fields of France with plenty of gas. By that time, the U.S. 7th Army had invaded southern France and drove north to link up. The delay in unifying the northern and southern command in France ensured the communist domination of southeastern Europe. None of this prevented the Soviet Union from recapturing much of their lost territory, having destroyed the German Army Group Center in the worst defeat ever to befall Germany, and pushed to just east of Warsaw. Other Soviet armies stood poised to clear the Baltic states, Romania, and Hungary. Already the Soviets had taken Poland and other territories. Churchill urged the United States to divert forces from the southern French landings to an amphibious invasion on the Adriatic side of Italy, where the Anglo-American forces could swing east and save large parts of the Balkans from Soviet conquest. But at the Tehran Conference in 1943, Roosevelt had promised Eastern Europe to Stalin. More important for Roosevelt, the Balkans were a sideshow to the main event, striking into the heart of Germany. Patton launched his armored invasion, bypassing Paris in pursuit of the fleeing German army, capturing an astounding 2,700 Germans per day. This allowed French partisans, in conjunction with the French 2nd Armored Division, to liberate the City of Light. General Charles de Gaulle led the procession down the Champs-Élysées in August 1944. With Bradley's armies gulping enormous quantities of fuel and consuming vast stockpiles of supplies, the Red Ball Express, a continuous trucking route from the beaches to the front, tried to maintain a flow of materials. Here, Eisenhower's good judgment failed him. Although Montgomery's forces seized the port of Antwerp, vitally needed to maintain the Allied flow of supplies, he failed to open the port's approaches so it could be used. With only enough fuel to keep one army group mobile, Ike chose to slow down both and adopt a broad front strategy of advance. In addition, to placate Montgomery, Eisenhower approved Operation Market Garden for a bold, paratrooper-armored joint thrust into Holland. Two American airborne divisions quickly met their objectives, but the armored 30 Corps failed to advance quickly enough to save the British paratroopers, and the offensive collapsed. Montgomery grudgingly agreed to open Antwerp, using Canadian forces rather than British. By the fall, Eisenhower had to economize on his own manpower uses, and as the weather worsened, the Allies slowed down until Antwerp could be fully operational and supplies gathered for the final push into Germany. Over Christmas 1944, American armies settled down for a hibernal regrouping. A contrast in governments. Meanwhile, a political non-event occurred back home. In November 1944, Roosevelt ran for a fourth term. Governor Thomas A. Dewey of New York, the Republican nominee, came remarkably close in the popular vote, 22 million to FDR's 25 million, but suffered a blowout in the Electoral College, 432 to 99. Dewey and the Republicans had virtually no platform. They supported the war and could hardly complain about FDR's wartime leadership. Roosevelt, by virtue of his control over presidential events at a time when gas and even newsreels were war materials, could overwhelm any foe with a propaganda blitz. To appease the party bosses, however, Roosevelt ditched left-wing Vice President Henry Wallace, who was certainly the most radical politician ever to hold that office, and replaced him with someone more politically appealing, Senator Harry S. Truman of Missouri. An election of sorts was also being held in Germany, where, not long after D-Day, a cadre of German officers attempted to assassinate Hitler with a bomb at his Wolf's Lair bunker. They failed. He had the ringleaders brutally executed. The contrast between the two episodes of choosing leadership, one in America, one in Nazi Germany, could not be clearer. In the totalitarian state where death reigned, Hitler escaped removal through luck, terror, and total control of the state media. But in the United States, even during a major war whose outcome still had not been decided, regular elections took place, and the Republican opponent mounted a substantial challenge to a popular incumbent. The Wolf's Lair assassination attempt reflected the desperation of the professional officer class in Germany, which was in sharp contrast to the deluded Hitler's fantasies of victory. Despite the increasing collapse of the Eastern Front, Hitler remained convinced that a sharp victory would turn American public opinion against the war and allow him to regain the initiative. He therefore stockpiled some 2,000 tanks, including the new Tiger IIs, an equal number of planes, and three full armies for a massive counterattack through Belgium under the cover of winter weather. Hitler still fantasized that he could split Allied lines, somehow force the United States to withdraw from the war, and defeat the Soviets in the east without pressure from the Western Front. In December 1944, the Battle of the Bulge began as Germans ripped a hole 45 miles wide in Allied lines. Devoid of air cover, Allied troops rushed poorly supplied units, such as the 101st Airborne under General Anthony McAuliffe, to key spots like Bastogne. Lacking winter gear and often without ammunition, the airborne forces nevertheless somehow held out as an isolated pocket in the German rear. When German negotiators approached, asking McAuliffe to surrender, he responded with the one-word reply, "Nuts." Then the weather cleared and the Nazi advance ground to a halt. Eisenhower's staff quickly assembled 11,000 trucks and 60,000 men to throw into the breach on a single day. Again, American productivity and volume of equipment overcame temporary tactical disadvantages as the American forces hurled 250,000 men at the German troops, spearheaded by Patton's Third Army, which arrived to rescue the 101st. To this day, living members of the 101st reject the notion that they needed rescuing. Either way, the outcome in the West was no longer in doubt. In another sense, however, the Battle of the Bulge was a post-war setback for the United States. By shifting massive forces away from the Eastern Front, Hitler had ensured that the Soviets, and not the Anglo-Americans, would capture Berlin. The Red Army, which had been at the gates of Warsaw since August 1944, advanced on Berlin in January of the following year with a manpower advantage of 11-1. Sweeping through western Poland, Silesia, and Pomerania, the Soviet forces stopped only 50 miles from Berlin in February, at the time Eich's resupplied troops prepared to cross the Rhine, which they did on March 7, 1945, when the First Army captured the bridge at Remagen that the Germans had intended but failed to destroy. Patton then crossed the Rhine 2 weeks later, ceremoniously urinating in the river, and Montgomery crossed a day after the Americans. Then Patton swung into Czechoslovakia and other Allied units reached the Elbe River. There, Eich ordered the troops to halt. He decided that Prague and Berlin were to be captured by Soviet forces. Patton fumed, arguing that he should march into the German capital before the Red Army. But Eich, wishing to keep out of the geopolitics, blundered by allowing the communists to bring historic and strategic cities into their empire. Shaping the post-war world. Soviet forces closed to within 50 miles of Berlin by February 1945, establishing communist regimes in Poland and Hungary. Austria was poised to collapse, and some of Finland lay in Soviet hands. In Eastern Europe, only Greece, where Churchill had dispatched British troops to prevent a communist takeover, remained out of Stalin's orbit. The communist dictator arrived at Yalta in the Crimea for a meeting with the other members of the Big Three, Churchill and Roosevelt, able to deal from a position of strength. From February 4th to the 11th, the three men deliberated the fate of post-war Europe. Stalin told the Western leaders he would brook no unfriendly governments on his borders. Yet, what exactly constituted the borders of an expansionist Soviet state? The boundaries of pre-war Russia? Germany? Stalin did not elaborate. In fact, the Soviets, stung by the loss of millions of lives during World War II and fueled by communist self-righteousness, fully intended to impose a buffer zone across all of Eastern Europe. Roosevelt had entered the alliance with a naive view of Stalin, believing the reports of his trusted advisor Harry Hopkins, later identified as a Soviet agent, that the Soviet dictator was interested in traditional balance of power concerns, not a buffer zone or an expansionist communist ideology. Roosevelt ignored the reality of Stalin's mass exterminations, which had exceeded Hitler's, going so far as to tell Churchill, "I think I can personally handle Stalin better than either your Foreign Office or my State Department." Roosevelt even admitted planning to give Stalin everything I possibly can and ask nothing from him in return, and therefore he won't try to annex anything and will work with me for a world of democracy and peace. This, of course, was Roosevelt admitting that he would violate the principles of the Atlantic Charter of August 1941, which he himself had co-drafted, and which prohibited turning territories over to occupying countries without the freely expressed wishes of the people concerned. No doubt his failing health contributed to the mistaken notion that he could control Stalin. Stalin promised free and unfettered elections in Poland at the earliest convenience, but neither there nor in other areas seized by the Red Army did the USSR take the slightest step to withdraw. Roosevelt, on the other hand, seemed obsessed with drawing the Soviets into the war with Japan, perhaps fearing the high casualties that he knew a full-scale invasion of the home islands would produce, and hoping that the Red Army would absorb its share. And at the time, FDR did not know with confidence that the atomic bomb would be ready anytime soon. He knew only that American scientists were working on it. He informed Stalin of the existence of such a program, to which Stalin responded with a shrug of indifference. The Russian dictator already knew about it, of course, through his spies, but that would only become apparent after the war. Among other agreements at Yalta, the Big Three decided to try German and Japanese principals as war criminals, creating, for the first time in history, a dubious new category of villainy for the losers of a conflict. The Holocaust, notwithstanding, it set a dangerous and perverse precedent, for at any time in the future, heads of state on the wrong side of a military outcome could be easily demonized and tried for crimes against humanity. Worse, unpopular winners could now find themselves accused of war crimes by losers whose religion or politics were shared by whatever majority of the international governing body happened at the time to be overseeing such nonsense. Predictably, critics of American policy in the Vietnam War some 20 years later would employ the same language against Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon. Yalta also produced an agreement to hold a United Nations conference in San Francisco in April 1945, with the objective of creating an effective successor to the old League of Nations. To Roosevelt, these concessions by Stalin indicated his willingness to work for peace. Little did he know that Soviet spies in the United States had already provided the Russian dictator with all the information he needed about the American positions, and thus he easily out-negotiated the woolly and wobbly Roosevelt. Others, however, noted that Stalin traded words and promises for carte blanche within territory he already held, and that having lost more than 20 million defeating Hitler, Stalin felt a few more casualties in the invasion of Japan seemed a cheap price in exchange for occupying large chunks of China, Korea, and northern Japan. Whether or not the Soviets would actually enter the conflict in the Far East remained a matter of doubt. What was not in doubt was the complete collapse of the Axis and the inglorious deaths of the fascist dictators. Allied armies closed in on Mussolini at Milan, He fled, only to be captured by Italian communist partisans who killed the dictator and his mistress. Then, with the Red Army entering Berlin, Hitler married his mistress, and the two committed suicide. On May 7, 1945, General Alfred Jodl, chief of staff of the German armed forces, surrendered unconditionally. VE Day, Victory in Europe Day, May 8, 1945, generated huge celebrations. These, however, would be tempered in relatively short order with revelations of the Holocaust and of the vast empire that the Soviets had now established. It cannot be ignored that more Jews would be gassed from the time Patton closed in on the German border in late summer 1944 until May 1945 than had been killed during the entire first 4 years of the war. Thus, there is some evidence to support the notion that a narrow front might have saved countless Jewish lives. The Holocaust and American Jews. Roosevelt's Soviet policy, which gave the communists undeniable advantages in post-war Europe, must be seen in the context of another issue in which pressures existed to divert resources from purely military aims, namely, a steady stream of information reaching the United States about the mass murder of Jews by the Nazis. America's response to news of this genocide, the Holocaust, patterned exactly FDR's approach to the Soviet advances and demonstrated remarkable consistency by the American government. In each case, the goal remained winning the war as quickly as possible. Roosevelt refused to veer off into any other direction, whether it involved denying the Soviets post-war footholds in the Balkans or diverting air power to bomb railroads leading to the Nazi death camps. In retrospect, however, the two issues were vastly different and required separate analysis and solutions. Hitler had made clear to anyone willing to read his writings or listen to his speeches that from at least 1919 he intended a Judenfrei, Jewish-free, Germany. Those who suggested he did not intend the physical extermination of the Jews ignore the consistency with which Hitler operated and the single-minded relentlessness of the Nuremberg laws and other anti-Semitic legislation. Most of all, they ignore Hitler's own language. He referred to Jews as subhuman, a bacillus, or as parasites on the German body. One does not reform a parasite or educate a bacillus. From his earliest speeches, he compared Jews to a disease. One does not exile a disease, one eradicates any sign of it. Hitler's anti-Semitism has been explained by a variety of factors, none completely convincing. His motivations are irrelevant in the long run.